Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-GM,
McGill. I am a GM.
All right. We got that much straight. This is Compare and Campaign. Used to be the podcast where we compared and contrast the campaigns of the past, but now it's a podcast where I tell stories about times I ran D&D sessions, and then we turn to McGill, and he's like, I got a cool new RPG for us to talk about.
That's right. In a way, we are comparing and contrasting, but we're not comparing our campaigns. In a way, we're sort of comparing RPG systems. You play 5e in your campaign, and then I bring whatever crazy RPGs I find to the RPG Danger Room.
And, like, more and more, I wish I was running something else.
Oh, well, hey, you know, I was going to say, at least we're catching up with Coyote's Aegis, but, of course, now Coyote's Aegis is off its hiatus, and it's resumed play, so there's lots more of it. So, sorry, Tom, you're going to have to deal with a lot more of that stuff before we can talk about a campaign from a different system.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is I feel locked in. It's like I don't want to drop my D&D game.
You gotta wrap it up, right? Like, this,
exactly.
It's been such a long story that you've been telling, a persistent world through multiple campaigns, and it only makes sense to, like, at least complete the trilogy.
Yeah. It's because it's even more than that. Like, I was planning to do, like, a quadrilogy. Like, I was planning to do another campaign after this one, Odium's Legacy. And, like, I just don't know how to spice it up such that I'm, like, really interested in it anymore, you know?
Well, what if you switch systems? What if you switch systems for the next one? The world, you've got all the lore written down. Why not just play it with a more Forged in the Dark-esque system, because I know you're into that these days.
Oh, maybe. The thing about that is that Forged in the Dark then, like, necessitates, like, a very... Every Forged in the Dark game has a very specific sort of game experience that they are tailored to, or at least I find the best ones are. And so, like, I don't know. I could see myself, if I were going to do a campaign that was all about, like, a mercenary company set in that world, then I could see myself doing Forged in the Dark for it. But that feels almost more like a spin-off than, like, an actual continuation of the overall...
I mean, I don't know about that. I feel like even just Blades in the Dark itself could lend itself to... what do you call these, like, the Saga of Drail, or the Epica, the Drail Legends, or something like that? Like, do you have a title for the overall
the
container?
MPOC Saga?
Yeah, the MPOC Saga. I could see something like Blades in the Dark working for it. Obviously, you'd be shifting sort of how each adventure comes about, but in something like Blades in the Dark, the characters are performing heists. Well, why can't you sub in ops for that instead, right? Like, your games are very mission-based, and it seems like Forged in the Dark games or Blades in the Dark, there's always a mission at the center of it. It's always something like, you know, downtime and planning, getting ready, you go on the mission, and then there's an aftermath phase of some kind. It varies from game to game, but it feels like that's sort of one of the core elements of those systems. And I don't see why something like Coyote's Aegis couldn't also fit into that. The thing that I see being more of a snag is that because these campaigns are very combat focused and systems like Blades of the Dark aren't as combat focused, maybe that would change. I couldn't really see you doing like the full grid maps for like a Blades in the Dark game, but maybe I'm wrong there too.
No, I think that's a fair thing to say. I don't know.
Spice up, make it Caltrop core.
I do kind of want to play more like Forts in the Dark games, like using D4s instead of D6s, because it's, you know, it's very slight change to the probability, but I don't know.
This is a bit of a tangential topic, Tom, but since you've brought up D4s, we're talking about Caltrop core. I have to ask, maybe I'm wrong here, but I have observed that you seem to have an interest in like the lowest level unit, I guess is what you could say. Like you have an interest in Caltrop core. Now you're talking about wanting to do Forged in the Dark, but with D4s instead of D6s. When we were playing Magna Gothica Malagast, you were very fixated on like thralls, like the lowest level unit. Is there like a common factor there? Is there a reason you're interested in sort of like the most boiled down base level element to a game like that?
I don't know that there's a correlation in the case of the thrall thing versus the dice thing. I don't know if I think of the D4 in the same way like that, but like, yeah, there is a sort of like a habit I have towards like reduction to base elements.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. I suppose there's like an elegance in the simplicity of it. It's just something interesting that struck me where it's like why do Blades in the Dark with D4s instead of D6s? I don't know, but obviously that appeals to you. The D4 seems to appeal to you more than the D6.
A little bit. Yeah, and like, I don't know. The thing is, if you make 1 and 2 failure, a 3 a mixed success, and a 4 a success, like, you haven't even changed the odds of failure. You've just altered the odds of success versus mixed success.
Wait, is this to do with your I wouldn't say fixation, but your interest in specifically the number 3?
Yeah, like it's definitely we're getting like
as close
it's we're getting as close to 3 as we can.
Got it.
Is a multiple of 3, so I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're taking a D4 and in a way you're like you've basically only got 3 results that you can get on a D4, is that as close to the 3 as you can get in dice form? I guess a D3 technically would be, but there is no D3, no physical D3 anyway.
Nah, no D3.
I think I have seen like a 3D printed attempt at a D3, a physical really? D3. Yeah, where it has like one curved side.
Weird.
Like 2 flat sides and a curved side.
Okay.
So you're talking more about Coyote's Aegis.
Yeah, my side of the podcast, it's another big boss fight. It's another demon that they have to interrogate. This time, I've included an image of how the fight starts out. And like my brother points out pretty early on that like the map seems to be in the shape of a spider, which that is like straight out of the module, which I believe is like, you know, it's like an actual canon place in like Forgotten Realms or something, but you know, an old drow location that's been built in the form of a spider.
Makes sense.
And yeah, they've got some demons to fight. There's a big magical aura circle. Yeah. It's like the boss of the second part of this module, of this battle, of this assault on the mantle.
This is it? Like, is this the boss battle?
For the second part.
For the second part, right.
But then there will be a third part, and that'll have a boss battle as well.
And after that third part, are we then up to the present?
No.
No.
Then we do an operation that was just me and my brother. So just doing an op, me and my brother playing some D&D together. And then things get kind of crazy. And we're still not caught up.
It is really astonishing to me how extensive these campaigns are. I gotta say, very impressive. Like, we're pushing 200 episodes. We're at episode 183, so we're approaching 200 episodes, and all you have talked about on this show in terms of the campaigns you've run, with like maybe the exception of a few little side spin-offs, but it's all been MPOC stuff. It's all been the MPOC saga, the stories of Drail, and it kind of boggles my mind to consider how much like in-game time you have devoted to it. That's a lot. Each session is what, 2-3 hours? 3 hours?
I'd say on average three hours.
And from what you've just said, like indicating how much there still is to cover, we're definitely going to get to episode 200, right?
Like, oh yeah.
Yeah. So taking all of this into account, if we wind up with 200 episodes of MPOC Saga content, and each of those is about 3 hours per session, so that's like 600 hours. That's like 25 straight days. If you were to nonstop roleplay Tom's campaigns that have been described on this show, you're looking at like 25 straight days without stopping, without sleep. That's wild.
I mean, I guess if you frame it that way.
Because, I mean, look at, you know, the first campaign I talked about, Minds of Metal and Wheels, was pretty trim. So it was like 30 hours, maybe 40 hours total. It's like not even a couple of days. Comparatively,
yeah, I guess.
If we were comparing campaigns, it is just really impressive to me that you've woven this extensive tale over so much time, and that your players have, a lot of them have stuck around through all of it, or at least the majority of it. People come and go, but
no, my brother's always there.
Yeah, exactly. How often did you play? Actually, the better question I could ask is MPOC's Finest. I know you've said it on the show, but when did that campaign start?
Oh my god, that...
or at least the year.
I think it was like 2015 or something.
2015. And on average, how often would you play?
Hold on. Once a week? I'm going to check the old book.
Once a week? Twice a week? Oh, did you date your entries?
Okay. So I checked, and MPOC's Finest started, it must have started like fall or winter. Yeah, like fall of 2014.
Okay, fall of 2014. And I was did you date your entries in your notebook?
Yes, generally.
Okay, cool. And so how often on average would you play?
The aim was always weekly.
Weekly, right on. Well, that's mighty impressive.
And I don't know, it's weird to have it's weird to say all that and then be like, I don't know, I'm having these misgivings about the game, but like,
Well, you've been
I
doing
don't
it for
know.
so long, it does make sense that you'd sort of be like, kind of want to do something new. Doing the mental math, though, weekly, and it started in 2014, but then, of course, it shifted. I guess I can't really average out how often you did actually play. So never mind.
Who knows?
Because it got more and more sporadic, and then of course there's a big gap too.
We haven't even talked about what we're covering on your side of the podcast yet, which I'm pretty excited about.
So off the top, when you guessed that I was a GM, my role was a GM, and you're right, the RPG I'm covering has a game master. But when you guessed that I was a GM and I said yes, you said, glad we got that straight. Well, let me tell you, that's about the only straight thing that we're going to be talking about in the RPG Danger Room as we talk about the role-playing game Extreme Meat Punks Forever, the tagline of which is Be Gay, Pilot Mechs, Kill Nazis. And this is one that we've sort of mentioned it in passing on the show. I got you a copy for Christmas. And we're finally going to cover it, and I suspect this will take a few episodes. It's a kind of, I don't know if I'd call it dense. It's an RPG that is dense with rules and lingo. You got to learn a system that is based on a few different things, like elements you've seen in other systems. There's a lot of terminology to get your head around. And the lore is also very extensive. There's just a lot of really interesting world building and plot elements and things like that to talk about. So on this episode, I'll be sort of giving an overview, talking about a few of the basic mechanics, but then just also talking about different things associated with the game that I came across when I was researching it. So yeah. RPG Danger Room topic is Extreme Meat Punks Forever, an RPG by Sinister Beard Games, authors Heather Flowers and Aura Bell.
So, do we want to kick things off talking about some crazy boss fight?
Yeah, fight that demon.
All right. So, we kick off and my brother's immediately like, what up, boss fight time. And just to remind the players, I say behind the trap door, the one they've just come through, they see another drow agent lying unconscious on the web-strewn floor. The spiders that skitter across every surface are swarming her, threatening to eat her alive. So we have a potential, person down that could need rescuing. Meanwhile, the fiend turns to face them. From the shadows, a vulture-like demon emerges, accompanied by another treacherous drow in the same equipment as the others. As the Vrock's abyssal stench washes over the group, the horned figure smiles. You took your time. Now you shall pay the price. And, about here, this is where my brother is like, is it me or is this room shaped like a spider? Which it
Spider
is.
room, spider room.
I say, given its location, this place likely belonged to the drow before the humans of Aegloch began their campaign of oppression. This might explain the architecture, and
I would say that the fact that this is a room in a drow area is enough to explain the spire architecture on its own, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I guess it's just the thing is that like it's not a known, like to them it's like a human supremacist area, and it's like, oh well, it used to be a drow area, right?
Right.
Suddenly, the end of the hall containing their foes goes pitch black, a sudden darkness enveloping all their enemies. Paylor grants Connor the sight to see through this trick, but the darkness obscures line of sight to the enemy. And Tex, their actual drow guide, not the traitor, not the secret guy who was trying to kill them, you know, if you remember that. Tex says, two can play at that game. Rushes to the side of the drow agent and, touching her cloak, throws up his own obscuring cloud of darkness. So on Gent's turn, Gent runs to the fallen drow and checks for vitals. And I say, she's alive, but not by much. The vicious spiders that dominate this room are making her chances slim. And so Gent gives her a regular healing potion, and she wakes, scrambling to her feet as she realizes the swarming arachnids all around her. She begins violently brushing the spiders off. She can't see, and neither can Gent, but her efforts can be heard. I also point out to Gent real quickly that they have access to the Gem of Seeing, which is something that may come in handy during this fight, considering lines of sight have just been obscured using the darkness spell. So, using fast hands to activate the gem, as well as administering the healing potion in the same turn, Gent activates the Gem of Seeing in order to see through the darkness perfectly. As can Connor, thanks to the eyes of Paylor. Unfortunately, I don't think Hex can see through magical darkness. Regular darkness, yes, thanks to the Robe of Eyes. But Alex is like, I can see into the ethereal plane, which is way neater than it is useful. Then it's Connor's turn. Connor reaches down to his belt and down to a potion of invulnerability. This is something we talked about. Connor walks into the darkness and shoots his sword off at the demon. These paltry tricks will not shield you from the dawn, fiend. Connor straight blasts fingers off this demon's right hand. The
Nice.
demon roars with fury as its digits fall smoking to the floor. Bonus action, Connor summons a shovel next to the quasits that have been summoned. And I say, a good hit, but don't forget you're meant to interrogate this fucker. And Alex is like, true, true. I say, he can still talk sans some talons, but the force of the blast is enough to remind you of the objective. And then with the shovel, the spirit shovel, he jabs a tiny demon in the throat, winding it. The tiny demons, skittering through the dark, turn invisible as the golden shovel hangs over them. Little do they know, Gent and Connor can still see them just fine. Suddenly, they all become aware of the rock throwing itself into the air, gliding out from the far end of the hall overhead, then setting down next to Tex and the female drow. The demon lets out a horrific, deafening screech, and everyone must make constitution saves. Connor is stunned for one round, and then it is Hexakila's turn. Hex hears the blasting screech and smells the deadly spores in the air. He begins to rage and charges through the darkness to recklessly engage the rock. The spirits of Hex's fallen brethren sweep through the pervading darkness. So Hex pulls out the scimitar, his scimitar, and makes three reckless attacks at the looming shape in the dark. Hex slashes the winged demon across the left knee, brings down his blade on the demon's right talons, then cuts deep into its right thigh. Then it's Gent's second turn, but we have to see if they make their constitution saving throw, which they don't. They are stunned by the sheer overwhelming pitch of the demon's scream. So unfortunately they lose this turn, but at least it was their second turn. As the female drow continues to brush spiders off herself, the demon in the crown reaches out to Connor and hisses some foul abyssal phrases. Connor must make a wisdom saving throw.
Connor foul abyssal phrases just makes me think that it's swearing at him.
It's probably actually trying to tempt him to his side. But Connor ignores the demon's attempt to influence him, his spirit full with the light of Pelor. The drow warriors on either side of the fight are staggered, clutching their ears following the fell sound produced by the vrock. Jen's back. So Jen asks, or Chantel asks, cool, so I can see, but we need to interrogate the vrock, so I aim at the baby demon. And I say, no, you need to interrogate the demon with the crown. The vrock is like a big vulture demon. And they're like, right, okay, different things. I will attack the vrock. And I say, yeah, but you can see, though. And I say, yeah, different types of fiend. I got a image here of the chaos of the battle as it unfolds with these two overlapping fields of darkness.
Oh, yeah. And wait, which was it? Hex that can't see in magical darkness?
Yeah.
Must be confusing for Hex.
He's just making reckless attacks at the vrock. Cancels out the disadvantage. And speaking about so Gent has advantage because the vrock can't see in the magical darkness produced by Tex. Oh shit. So then Jank gets a 30 to hit. I'm like, killer. Shot through the demon heart! And then Jen attempts to hide, but then I'm like, oh wait, I made a slight error. The rock was actually not in darkness because the stun effect would have removed the darkness effect. And but Jen still gets sneak attack for allies. So really no effect. I just wanted to clear up the current state of the battlefield. Gent hides behind one of the pillars they're standing by, and they duck behind a pillar. They say, I am the shadow. Connor is still dazed from the deafening screech of the vrock. I say, a ghost shadow in the night. And Gent says, oh my god, Gent is Darkwing Duck. I say, Darkwing Gent. Connor, and Hex need to make wisdom saving throws. And Alex says, Hex is more Duck Dodgers from the 31st and one half century. Probably because of his laser pistol. I say Hex is giving me Bucky O'Hare vibes. Meanwhile, Alex says Connor spends a lot of his time doing Foghorn Leghorn. As Connor is still disoriented from the screech, one of the quasits pops out of invisibility ahead of him, distorting its face into a horrifying visage that is worsened by Connor's delirious moment. Connor is frightened and may repeat the save on his turns, but has disadvantage as long as he can see the quasit. Hex needs to make a series of wisdom saves as well. The quasits each pop out of invisibility, attempting to startle Hex by taking on the pained faces of the spirits that surround him, but Hex isn't fooled, and he has bigger demons to thrash that have his attention at the moment. Everyone makes constitution saving throws as the vrock shakes out a cloud of toxic spores from its wings. Connor is poisoned, the spores drifting into the damaged parts of his armor to sicken his skin. Hex lights up the crucifix scimitar and keeps wailing on the vrock recklessly. He traces a burning cut across the bird demon's midsection. Hits him for a headshot. The demon rasps and shudders as Hex strikes it across the head, then slices into its gut. Having gotten the spiders off of her, the female drow runs for cover behind the pillar behind the one Gent is by. disengaging from the Vrock. Having failed to entrance Connor, the demon makes the same gesture towards Hex. Hex must make a wisdom saving throw. Suddenly, Hex feels his energy fading. He begins to lose his fury as a gentle voice in his mind tells him to let go, to simply follow the voice. Darkness descends on Hex and the rest of the party as the fiend flies into the part of the hall that they are positioned in. Hex is currently charmed and is being instructed against his will to stop fighting. He may save again if he takes damage or is in danger. Connor, frightened and poisoned, sees the two drow combatants on either side of the fight. Tex and the drow aiding the demons float above the combat, out of the darkness, engaging each other. Connor sees the fiend rake Tex's back with his claws as the drow rises into the air. Connor sees the two drow kick off into the air. Tex manages to bring his mighty blade up into the other drow as they take off, dealing significant damage. The other drow attempts to return the favor, but Tex parries the blow as he rises into the air. Then, on Jent's turn, Jent can detect the demon they need to interrogate standing 10 feet away. I say, don't forget that you have the mirror that you took from Din. And Jen says, yes, I will sneak up to him and attempt to trick him into looking into the mirror. I say, you can also attempt to knock off his crown with a melee attack at disadvantage. Jumping out from the behind the pillar, they turn the mirror on the fiend. As soon as he looks Jent's way, his eyes widen and blood begins to leak from them. A slow trickle at first, but soon blood is cascading from his eyes, covering his vision. So, Jent. To Jent, the demon is blind. And I say, now if you want to try and knock his crown off, it would be a normal attack. Otherwise, Jent has has advantage to attack, and Jent says, okay, I'll try to do that. Knock it off. Can I use my rapier? I say, whatever you like. They get a 30 to hit. I say, I'm assuming you drew the rapier. And so they lift the fine, sinister blade, which reaches out toward their prey like a hungry tendril, quivering in anticipation. They're forced to disappoint it slightly, flicking their wrists such that the point goes up and slips under the ring of the fiend's iron crown. With another flick, they send the crown flying across the room, clattering into the steps behind them to become bogged in webbing and spiders. No! The demon roars in frustration, still sputtering through its sanguine tears. Jent disengages and pops back behind the pillar. Connor takes one poison damage, and then it is his turn, though he is frightened and poisoned. Connor casts Firestorm. Lights up everybody except the demon, rolling 56 damage, save for half. It also incinerates the webbing and spiders in the area. It actually hits Connor and Hex as well. Hex gets a nat 20 on his save, and Connor fails, but he has pyro armor, so he takes half damage. Even if they save, this is too much damage, too much fire for the Quazzets. The tiny demons are cooked to tiny demonic crisps, the flames stoked by the surrounding spiders and their webs below. And,
do they then make a meal out of the tiny crisp demons? I feel like that's the next logical step with this party.
Like, you'd think so, but I don't think it happened. The enemy drow is not caught in the flames, but Connor manages to effectively cook him as though on a spit over a hot flame. Combined with the wound Tex dealt them when they took off into the air, the enemy drow is seriously wounded. The Vrock fails to save. Its wings go up in flames, demon feathers drifting through the air around them as they burn to cinders. Alex says, I bet it smells awful. Uh, Connor is no longer afraid, having effectively vaporized the source of his fear, like a cornered rat with powerful magic abilities, Alex says. Hex shakes off the fiend's influence as he feels the sheer scouring heat of the flames on his scaly hide. Clutch casting from Connor right there. And Alex says, that's my new spell at level 22. First time using it. The disc of blood boils and crackles as the webs below burn. We had a little side conversation here about, like, I was like, does he not get level 9 spells? And he's like, no, he does. I just find cleric level 9s are highly situational and are better picked at start of day than as a set thing. I only usually prep a mass heal. Other situations might call for something else, but it's been a lot of warfare lately. The Vrock lets out an avian shriek, shaking its now ashen wings to release a cloud of spores that goes out like ash from a volcanic site. Also, the firestorm does burn away the benefit of Connor's displacement cloak temporarily. He is still under the effects of the invulnerability potion, though, so he takes half of half. So everybody's got to make con saves against these spores again. Spores drift around the pillar and get caught in their feathers, irritating them. They are poisoned. On Hex's turn, Hex once again strikes out at the swirling shadow that is the Vrock in the dark. He strikes the Vrock in its lower left leg. We had forgotten Connor using his magic shovel. So the glittering spade cuts through the dark up into the drow's left knee. The drow is in the air. Hex cuts away at the Vrock's upper right wing, which is already brittle and burnt, then continues to hack at the demon's right wing. The demon lets out a painful squawk as they continue to sever its useless right wing. He says, bonus action, I bite the burb. I say, welcome to Dirty Bird. Can I take your order? And he gets the 18 to hit. I say, Hex is having wings tonight. The horned demon producing the darkness continues to wipe its bleeding eyes, choking on the caustic fumes given off by its own ally. Unable to see properly, the fiend lashes out at Hex, but Hex blocks the claws with his bracers, barely noticing the impact of the demon's talons. Jent and Connor can see as Tex swings his mighty executioner's blade, decapitating the other drow in midair, sending their head crashing into the burnt webbing below with a sickly crack. Tex, victorious, drifts safely back down to the ground while his opponent's body is torn down by gravity with much less ceremony. Jent itches at the spores in their feathers, feeling the sting of the poison. They take 9 poison damage after reduction, and then it is their turn. Jent rushes over and grabs the fiend's crown. And then I point out that they can take a shot at the horned fiend with advantage because he is now specifically averting his gaze from Jent. Alternatively, they can fire on the Vrock regularly, but with sneak attack from allies. But because they are poisoned, they have disadvantage on the Vrock, so no sneak actually. But they could get regular with sneak on the fiend. He is the interrogation target. So you'd have to go for non-lethal attack if you went into melee. So, they try for a non-lethal attack. They rush the demon as he's averting his gaze. They get a nat 20. They feel the Vrock's poison sapping their strength and dulling their senses. But they're able to take their time with their prey because he's not actively looking at them. They wait until just the right moment to thrust their vile rapier into the fiend's right knee. A torturous, crippling shot. So they get just an insane amount of damage because there's tons of crit effects on that vile rapier. And I say, as your blade, seemingly alive with thirst for blood, sinks into the demon's knee, the fiend lets out a wail of agony that fades into a gasp. He shudders, begins shivering. You twist the blade before retracting it, and the demon falls forward onto his face. The darkness surrounding them fades. Hex and Tex are still engaged with the vrock, cutting at it mercilessly. The fiend writhes on the floor, coughing a wet, hacking cough, unable to speak intelligibly through the sheer excruciating pain. Meanwhile, Connor attacks the vrock with his spirit shovel, but does not hit. The demon ducks the blow. Then he throws a guiding bolt at the vrock that it catches in the left wing. The demon engages Hex now that both are out in the open, clearly visible to one another. But no hits. Despite his reckless fury, Hex headbutts and blocks and batters the demon's mighty talons away. Tex attempts to further ensure their advantage against the demon, casting fairy fire to light it up with bright magical neons, but the monstrous fiend shakes off the influence of the spell. Jed takes 8 poison damage, and then it is their turn. Their only remaining target is the vrock, which is granting advantage, so they would be able to attack normally with sneak due to poison.
It's one tenacious vrock.
Yeah. I think it had like 300 health or something like that. But I think the party is level 20 now. Yeah. So, they sink their shot into the demon's bird-like form. Jet aims for the demon's liver, if it has one, and deals significant damage to its internal organs. It's not dead yet, but it certainly will be in short order. Connor misses with the spirit bolt, then throws another guiding bolt, striking what's left of its right wing. As the ashen wing breaks off at the demon's back, it succumbs to its wounds, slumping to the floor. And meanwhile, their target, the interrogation target, the fiend, lays there shuddering. So, this is one of these times that we noticed that, so we've got this situation here where Connor and Jen are both poisoned, and they just, like, can't seem to pass their saves. And then I realize that the pre-reactive proof against poison that Hex carries is not an attunement item. And so they can literally just pass it around until everybody feels better. little exploit that you can do with that one magic item.
D&D hack.
Yeah. Hex turns to the demon on the ground. Now, what exactly were you trying to accomplish with that? Seems like it didn't work. Hex steps on the demon's ruined hand. The demon spits. Not at Hex, but to the side, sending some foul ichor spattering across the ashen stone floor. As their foot comes down, he shrieks like the vrock. Not the stunning screech, but the pain sound it made when Hex was removing its right wing. It's no matter, he rasps. Despite his position, the fiend's tone is almost mocking. The Dark Prince walks in your world now, and has opened the gate to all our kind. Ha! Maybe he could lend you an extra finger. What is the blood disc for? And Jen says, and this creepy headgear. The demon looks up at Hex, tries to grin, but it quickly fades into a wince. It's no matter. Just another hole in your world. The demon follows Jen's voice to see them, but quickly averts their gaze. He will rule your world. A crown for a new prince. Hex turns to Connor and jerks his head toward the blood disc. Connor approaches it and casts Dispel Magic. At the same time, the remaining strength in the demon seems to fade as though it were reconnected to the ritual. As the fiend dies, the circle of blood collapses. As the circle of blood disintegrates, they see a mighty greataxe fall clattering out of it to the floor, throwing up a cloud of ash. Connor says, "Neat," and goes over and picks it up. The blade of this immense platinum great axe is a single piece of black ice lashed to a steel haft. The blade cracks and weeps constantly as though it is melting, though it never diminishes in size. I believe this this axe is called Rhyme Splitter and is still being used today in the Coyote's Ages. Between the spoils of the battle and their payment for this part of the operation following the assault on the mantle, everyone gets 1,300 gold, bringing Gent's new total to 25,804 gold. And that is where we broke. We pick up next time. Next time we'll pick up with Tex and the drow they rescued. That's two theaters out of three down. They got to get ready for the big push.
Oh, man. Wow. I like that you're keeping us updated on their gold totals. I feel like there's not going to be a test on this, is there, Tom? Should I have been adding all of these up?
Nope. Oh, I've been adding them up. I've just been tracking them through whatever Gent's total is because I just had it on hand.
Gotcha. So, I mean, as you said, this was another big boss battle. Had some real dramatic moments in there. But how are your players feeling about this? I know we got like a little bit of player commentary, but I keep remarking on how huge this op is. Were any of them talking about it? Maybe not like at the table, but outside of the game.
I mean, it was all over Discord, but Gent said, "Woohoo! That's awesome swag." Alex said, "Dope sesh, guys." Generally spirits were high.
Right on.
I'd say. Unless they were lying.
But what would be the point of that? Especially over a chat like Discord. Ridiculous. Yeah. Well, one more theater to go in this op. And then there's even more.
Giant spiders by land. By sea. Cloakers by air, giant spiders by land. What?
Maybe one of those giant spiders was used to assist in shaping the room where this fight took place.
I don't know about that.
Oh, not that giant then.
Yeah, I don't. I just don't think of them as having stone carving ability.
No, but you could, you know, someone who can carve stone could use one as a template.
I guess. I think it's older than that. I think the spiders are newer than the place was old.
Well, fair enough. Time for me to drop this dumb line of conversation.
Okay. I mean, I was following it.
You want to talk about extreme meat punks forever?
Yeah, ask me which meat punk playbook I want to do.
Oh, wow. Okay. I guess we'll lead with that. Which meat punk playbook do you want to do?
Which one do you think I want to do?
Oh, boy. The Weird or the Wisp?
It's pretty cool. I mean, you have a pet cryptid that obeys with you. That obeys you. That's a cool ability.
Is that not the one?
No, that's not it.
The meat shifter?
Hell yeah! Got it in two. Love me a meat shifter.
So, I mean, not to get ahead of ourselves, but Extreme Meat Punks Forever, the role-playing game by Heather Flowers and Aura Bell, published by Sinister Beard Games. This is a role-playing game set in a strange, squishy, flesh-themed world, and it's all about, it's like biomechanical mechs, biomechanical, armored exoskeletons fighting Nazis specifically, but fascists in general, with many themes of queerness throughout. And the first thing, Tom, I found out about this game through you. You're the whole reason I know about this. And so imagine my surprise when I found out that there is, in fact, a whole other facet of the Extreme Meat Punks Forever universe as I was researching this. You know what I'm talking about?
The game?
Yeah, this is a series of video games, man. I had no idea.
Also available on Itch, I believe.
Yep. Itch.io. HTHR. It's Heather without the vowels. itch.io/extreme-meatpunks-forever. And you can get the game, these video games. There are 5 episodes, and then I guess 6 if you include this like epilogue finale episode. And they are like mech fighting, retro mech fighting games that are also visual novels, basically. They're visual novel / brawler games. I had no idea. And so somehow I missed this in the middle of all of this, even buying you the game. I missed this. Wow. Hang on. Oh, you know what's really wild? I even own it. I own these games. But there's a reason that I didn't realize that I actually own them. I was looking at the itch.io page for the Extreme Meat Punks Forever video games, and at the top it says, "You own this game." I was like, "Do?" And it's because
it was in one of those huge bundles, right?
It was, yeah, that's right. In 2020, I bought this huge bundle where all the proceeds... It was a bundle for racial justice and equality, where all the proceeds were donated to the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And I was like, that is, of course, a terrific value, but... it's only $5 and you got 1,741 games. And some of these games are already great. Like Celeste is one of those games. That's a really excellent platformer. Night in the Woods is a really fun, like half platformer, half, I don't know what you'd call it. It's sort of, it's really just a story. Like there aren't a lot of puzzles in it. It's just sort of like, I guess it's a kind of a role playing game, or visual novel maybe. But, really nice game. A Short Hike is another good one. And Overland is one that I had my eye on for a while, where it's almost like these isometric dioramas where it's like one part Oregon Trail and then one part like tactical survival game. So it's these little dioramas and then you fight like giant bugs and things as you progress across the land. So there were some like actual mainstream known games in there that alone made this bundle worth $5. But then of course there on top of that is like over 1700 other games included. And deep in here somewhere is the Extreme Meat Punks Forever series. But it's funny, even knowing that, like I'm scrolling through the big list of all the games and there are just so many, I can't even find it. There's so many in here, my God. I don't think I could ever in my lifetime play all of these games. Anyway, all that to say, somehow I already own the video game of Extreme Meat Punks Forever. And while I was trying to do research into the RPG, the TTRPG, I kept just coming across reviews and Let's Play videos of the video game. And that was a little frustrating because it's like, no, I want the TT RPG. And thankfully, I did actually find a good little playthrough snippet of the game from a podcast called Plus One Forward. And Plus One Forward, it looks like this is also kind of like ours, our podcast rather. Kind of like our podcast, it is a focus on RPGs, looking at different systems. And on this episode of Plus One Forward, they brought on Heather and Aura, the design team behind Extreme Meat Punks Forever, and then discussed the game, talked about its development, and then even do like a little 15-20 minute session, which they play through the first encounter of the first built-in one-shot, I guess you could say. They're not campaign ideas, but this includes different like little one-shot adventures. So Plus One Forward, the episode on Extreme Meat Punks Forever, if you want to really see this system in action a bit. And yeah, and there are also this serial, like episodic video game series available on Itch. So there you go. There's a lot of extreme meat punks out there to enjoy. Now, it says up front on the first page of the source book that this game is powered by the apocalypse. And I believe we've only covered one other powered by the apocalypse game on this show. Do you remember what it is, Tom?
I think the only one we've covered in detail was City of Mist.
That's right. And City of Mist remains my primary experience with Powered by the Apocalypse. So I was expecting something akin to that from Extreme Meat Punks Forever. That is not what this game is. This game is quite different from City of Mist in a lot of ways. I found this to be, like, sure, it's Powered by the Apocalypse, but a lot of the lore reminded me of Fleshscape. A lot of the stuff to do with mechs and mech combat, like it almost reminded me a bit of Rifts in some ways, just in terms of the flavor. There are elements of this that remind me of Forged in the Dark, like little clocks. There are some clocks in here. The playbooks reminded me a lot of Forged in the Dark playbooks. Much more so than City of Mist, because of course City of Mist, you're like answering questionnaires and the character sheets are these little pamphlets. So I found that interesting, and this has intrigued me enough that at some point I'm going to have to actually sit down and read more on just the Powered by the Apocalypse system in general, so that I can figure out what the actual commonalities are. Like, it's hard for me to see the intersection of the mechanics of City of Mist and Extreme Meat Punks Forever. So I'm going to start off by just reading this little introductory blurb that really sets the stage and tells you about the world, because, you know, I'd use the author's words more than my own to give you a sense of where this all takes place. In the beginning, there was meat, a decaying chunk of flesh from a dying god, hurtling through the void of space thousands of miles wide, a million eyes, a billion hands, grasping for purchase against nothingness itself. If it had a mouth, it would scream, a terrified, lonely monster, separated from itself for the rest of eternity, paying some sort of penance for the act of being alive. This is the creature upon which we all live. Our scientists estimate that the flesh god, known as Meat World to its inhabitants, came into orbit around the now stolen sun several billion years ago, its surface covered with space debris and eventually life. One would be surprised to find the difference in origin between our world and yours. We have dirt, forests, mountains, deserts. None of it seems particularly unusual. It's when you get into the details that you notice the difference. You see, we meat worlders are resourceful people. While your world was rich in metals, ours was not. We were given flesh, and so flesh we used. We became skilled in the act of meatallergy. Tom, meatallergy. This is a Tom word. Using the whole meat, a metaphor.
But we've already talked about this because we covered it in our brief preview of Extreme Meat Punks Forever in the past.
Yeah, I know.
About meat allergy.
Of course. I'm back on it. I'm back on my meat allergy. We became skilled in the art of metallurgy, bending the living forces of nature to our will. It is a dangerous art, and an unnerving one to behold, but I think you'll find the results to be worth it. After all, we live in a dangerous world. It's only right that we become dangerous ourselves. The crown jewel of Meat World, its capstone, is the mech, a half-dead mound of flesh that a human can pilot by connecting their nerve systems together. Mechs can range from meaty suits of armor to mountain-crushing mile-high monstrosities, but the average size of a personal mech is roughly 12 to 20 feet tall. A mech is a deeply personal thing. It responds to your soul. It becomes part of you as much as you become a part of it. You must impart your deepest secret to it before piloting. Your mech name, your true name, the thing that ties you to yourself. Never speak it to another. The other thing you should know about Meat World is, there's no good way to put this, a while back, the sun disappeared. There one day, gone the next. Instead, we have the bright, a glowing firmament sky with mysterious origins. It gets bright and dark seemingly at random, and it can turn any color of the rainbow. It sounds dystopian, but wait until you see that hot pink bright fall over the fleshland spires. There's nothing like it. This world is wild and beautiful, and while it bears the scars of our mistakes, I hope you can learn to love it. Not in spite of those scars, but because of them. The groves of bioluminescent trees, the mutated rat wolves lurking in the shadows, the double crows and murder horses, and all of it. It's wonderful and terrible all at once, and I love it dearly. Welcome to Meat World. We hope you enjoy your stay. And the lore on this is that that was Dora Godkiller's first cross-dimensional transmission in 1993. And there's a really wild looking, I guess that's a meat mech, but it's sort of like a multi-limbed bird skeleton with like a sort of a demonic pair of legs, all wrapped in nerves and flesh and muscle. So I don't know. It's hard for me to sort of pick an entryway into this game that isn't just like going through the notes in the source book. Because like I said, it has a degree of density to it where I can't just immediately compare it to like one other thing. Sure, it has the standard RPG dynamic of a GM and then a bunch of players. And roles are called for in this case. It's this D6 based system. You roll 2D6 and then you can add like a number from one of your stats, and then the results of those 2D6 rolls are sort of like charted out, like 7 or higher is a hit, 6 or lower is a miss, a 10 or higher is a strong hit, 7, 8, or 9 is a weak hit. And there are even ways to get above 12, which is the max you can roll on your dice. A miss, 6 or less, isn't necessarily the same as a failure. It just means the GM gets full say over what happens next, and chances are you won't like it. The GM will probably make things worse for you in some way. But yeah, this is another one of those RPGs where the players do seem to have quite a lot of agency in telling the story as well. So, you know, a failure is just like they have to give up their agency in the story and the GM gets full say. But besides that, it sounds like this is a case where it's a system that, you know, similar to Forged in the Dark, where players can take the reins, take the spotlight, say, you know, suggest things that happen, and the GM just sort of like adjudicates in case they go a little too far, says like, okay, we can do that, but then this also happens, things like that. And then the sort of worst possible scenario in terms of rules is that the players have to surrender and the GM gets to make all the decisions. There's an advantage and disadvantage system as well. In this case, advantage means you roll 3d6 and take the top two results, and disadvantage is 3d6, you take the bottom two results. And all of that, like I said, you have your own statistics. What do they call that? Are they just attributes? Are they stats? Let me pull up the playbooks. Stats. Your stats are attention, chill, awkward, and guts. And then the stats are, rather than a number, they're just a spread a spectrum of modifiers. Minus 2 to plus 3. So you can have minus 2, minus 1, 0, plus 1, plus 2, plus 3 as your modifier for that stat. And then when you roll on it, you roll 2d6 and apply whatever stat modifier is appropriate. And then this was something that I thought was interesting is the primary sort of mechanic for doing things in the game are these moves. And I feel like we haven't really seen this before in other games, these move sets. Do you recall, Tom? I've covered so many RPGs now. They're all just mixed up in my brain.
God, I feel like I've seen... Oh, geez, I don't know, man. Now I'm all mixed up.
In a way, these moves... let me just read this little bit of text here. Every player character gets the basic moves, and then they each have their own playbook moves. And
wasn't there moves in City of Mist?
Were there? It was so long ago now. I feel like no, there weren't moves really. Cause City of Mist had that very fluid system of. Character abilities, where you answer those questionnaires, and the answers to those questions from the questionnaires, it was a case of any time that you did anything that pertained to one of the answers from the questions that were on your sheet, then you get a bonus to it. So it was things like, you know, what is your prized possession? I think you said, was it your gun or something like that? There was a character who was
like... But there is player moves in City of Mist.
Oh, man. Okay. It's been too long. God, my brain is mush. Too many RPGs in here. But in this case, so the moves are sort of like, in Extreme Meat Punks Forever, are sort of like a combination of something like skill checks from D&D and also abilities... from something like a Forged in the Dark game. Sort of like all of this sort of happens under this umbrella of things called moves. And the moves are just like, they're not even actions necessarily. Like, I guess move is like the best word for it, but it's just sort of like things that you can do. And in listening to the actual play segment from that episode of Plus One Forward, the way that this game plays is it seems like the players may say this, or like the player or the GM might sort of apply a move from the different move sets, be they the moves in the playbooks or the basic moves or mech moves or pain moves or heart moves or whatever, to whatever the players say they want to do. So a player will say something like, I want my character to go over and confront the drunk at the bar. And then either the player or the GM would say, that sounds like you want to get shit done. One of the moves is get shit done. When you do something dangerous or dicey. And then when you get shit done, you roll 2d6 plus your chill modifier. On a hit, you do it. If you manage to get above 12, you do it and look rad. Pick someone present. If they're an NPC, they're impressed, scared, or in awe. If they're an OC, which is an original character, also a PC, a player character, I guess you'd call it, they can choose to catch feelings about you to mark XP. And then on a 7 to a 9, the GM introduces a complication or a hard choice. I said catch feelings there. Catch feelings is another move. There are heart moves, which are more sort of emotionally charged moves, and things like catching feelings. Catching feelings means you develop a crush on a character. So there you go. There's a move for everything. What I find interesting about this is the way that things like stats sort of fit into moves, and then the moves fit into the role play. It's not quite as A to B as something like Dungeons and Dragons. In Dungeons and Dragons, for example, if you're like, do I hear any sounds coming out of the woods? Then you would probably roll perception, and that makes a lot of sense, where it's like, do I hear? I roll perception. But in this case, it's sort of like, I don't know, I feel like there's an extra step. It's not quite so A to B. It's like figuring out which things fit into which moves. And then each move has its associated stat and then like a variety of results. I don't know. I feel like I'm kind of rambling about this. It's interesting to me looking at these move sets as a method of play. It feels different than something like calling on a skill check in D&D. What do you think, Tom? I don't know. Am I making any sense here? Nope. Not me.
I'm also kind of just like going through the Meat Punks, the Extreme Meat Punks Forever rule book at the moment, just like looking at the different moves and everything. Looking at mech moves, things like that. I don't know.
I think the reason this sticks out in my brain, it's probably just because I am not experienced with this system. I say things like, you know, like the D&D skills, it all comes very naturally to my brain just because I've played that system for so long. And I'm sure that I would get the hang of this, get the flow of Extreme Meat Punks Forever if I just played it for any sustained period of time. But it's interesting to me thinking about acting as GM and saying like, well, it sounds like you want to do this thing, so it sounds like you're going to fuck around and find out. So fuck around and find, you know, we're going to do fuck around and find out. And then when you fuck around and find out, you roll guts. So roll 2d6 plus guts. Here's my thought on it. I figured out the words. Why not just say roll a guts check? Why does it have to be you're gonna fuck around and find out, so roll guts?
I mean, because they're giving it their own flavor, man. It's like a huge part of this game, I'd say.
I think it might be a little... There might be a little more reason than that. Obviously, it is given the game its own flavor. But looking over the different moves, I guess it's because there are only so many stats, but there are several different ways to apply them. So I guess that's the distinction. Is, like get shit done is doing something dangerous or dicey. Difficult or scary to the point where the outcome is uncertain. But fuck around and find out is actively getting into a fight, right? So there is a real distinction there in terms of the check. Let me see if I can find two that use the same thing. Here we go. Okay. So have it out is when you confront someone about a difficult subject. But backscratch is when you offer someone something to get something in return. In both cases, you're rolling an awkward check. But there is a distinction on the different effects it has. But I guess the thing that I find interesting, though, is the need to have those distinctions on top of the check. Like, something in, like, D&D, you can say, roll a strength check. And a strength check can be anything from, like, you know, slapping an NPC to trying to pry open a door. It's just sort of like multi-purpose like that. What I find interesting in this system specifically, Extreme Meat Punks Forever, is that they then specify the applications. It's one level deeper than that. None of these things are general purpose. They're all a bit more specific, and then each action has its own sort of consequences to when you do it. Like, figure shit out has if you roll a 10 or plus, you get to ask two questions. If you roll 7 to 9, you can ask one question. But then the have it out move, when you confront someone about a difficult subject, you roll plus awkward for NPCs or plus love for PCs. And then there are different charts here. On a 10 or more, hold 3. On a 7 to 9, hold 2. Spend your hold to select options from the lists below. Better for NPCs. One hold, you get advantage on your next roll against them. One hold, you get... they get sad, emotional, angry, whatever, and go away for a bit. Or two hold, they really consider your words. So, like, the have it out move effectively generates almost like a form of currency, hold points, and then you spend your hold points based, like, on little charts that only apply to that one move. And there are, like, extensive rules here about... how the hold works. The hold you spend gives you tools to move towards resolution, but they don't solve the problem outright. I guess when I said, you know, it's dense, I guess it really is. It is dense like that, because it's almost like you gotta... I'd have a hard time keeping all this in mind. Running this game, I would definitely be flipping around between these pages of moves just to make sure that I get everything that goes into that move. Like, there is a move here, take a moment. To resolve a status, you've got to dedicate a scene to dealing with it, involving either another player or an NPC. It's perfectly cool to raise that you want to do this out of character and ask which PCs want to be involved before heading back into the fiction. But then there's, like, physical healing, emotional healing. Different things happen depending on the type of healing you're doing. So it really, like, it's all these sort of miniature systems within the basic moves of the game and within, like, all these different moves of the game. That's interesting. I think that's an interesting way of getting into it, of handling a system like this. I mentioned statuses. Statuses we've definitely covered before, and I'm pretty sure they were in City of Mist, as well. Yeah. And, It's that thing, much like City of Mist, where instead of they're like a mini workshop for custom moves. When it comes time to inflict a status, your best bet is to invent it on the spot. There are some included for inspiration, and they are things like exhausted, starving. We could get really crazy. Blood sneezers. You're coughing and sneezing up blood because of internal injuries. Intoxicated. In shock. Furious, pissy, anxiety, guilt, heartbreak. These are all statuses that your character might get, and you're encouraged to come up with your own as well. Another game that this was reminding me of quite a bit was The Gates, the game that Lukeo designed, because there is a big focus in Extreme Meat Punks Forever on, besides all of these mechanics that I've been talking about, there's a big focus on things like addressing trauma and addressing issues of identity. And it doesn't quite blur the line between in the game and outside of the game the way The Gates does. The Gates really has a focus on sort of these different levels of being in the game versus being who you are. Extreme Meat Punks Forever doesn't really have that, but it does seem like it has an intent towards enabling players to grapple with their own trauma or roleplay trauma that their characters have and purge it cathartically, especially in the fact that the game is very focused on, like, fighting fascism, fighting these oppressive evil forces. You know, it's like be gay, do crime in a mech. So I think that's a really interesting aspect of it as well. I wanted to, you know, because I was saying that I like to look at the game being played as a means of really understanding it and getting into it. So I was reading through just like the game master section on this, talking about the first session, like how to start a campaign of meat punks. And something that I thought was interesting was in the section under the story, it says, don't plan a story out. You're all contributing, you will all contribute to the evolving story. And if one person has a long form idea of where everything is going to go, not everyone can freely contribute. Momentum dies, and then it's just a table full of people listening to one person tell a story. Instead, think of loose situations. What if this group did this thing? What if she wanted that? And don't decide on a resolution or answer. This reminded me of Wicked Ones. I don't know what it was like running Teeth. I'm not sure if you had more of a linear narrative in mind when you were running it. But certainly in Wicked Ones, I did what the sample scenarios from Extreme Meat Punks do, which is basically you have a location and maybe you have something in the form of a clock and you have some NPCs and then you sort of release the players into it and they decide how they interact with it. It's in another RPG, I might call this like a location-based adventure, but it's really more of a sandbox. It reminded me of like the sandbox and the raids from Wicked Ones. So like as an example here, Tales of the Meat Punks is the section, and they have these different scenarios. The first one is Ghost Town, and so it gives you a hook, like a place, Tornado Valley. A storm starts brewing, there's a bar and grill, and so the players have to get in out of the storm, and they walk into this, like, Mos Eisley scum and villainy-style cantina. There are, you know, fascist drunks getting shit-faced at a table. There are other NPCs around. What do you do? And then on the plus one forward episode, this was the scenario that they were playing. And so it's sort of like, what do you do? And you just kind of cut the players loose and see what they do. And in the background of all that, there is a big countdown of events that will happen at different times, regardless of what the players do. So at noon, the meat punks get into a bar fight with a group of fascists. Fash, they're called in game. That quickly turns into a mech brawl. While this fight happens, a storm is beginning to brew. And then in the afternoon, the town cook is found dead in the town square with no face. At dusk, everyone goes to work in the fields, leaving the town empty. And then things happen during that time. I won't read them all out because there's like a whole paragraph of them. Brightfall, which is nightfall, of course, I guess, because there's no sun. Brightfall, a storm begins to gather on the horizon. Midnight, everyone gathers in the town hall to weather the storm. Dawn, there's a ghost, and the ghost, still under the supervisor's control, emerges and tears into the town hall, consuming everyone inside. So it's not like there's a linear story, but there's like this countdown in the background, and then there's just like a big location with different NPCs and encounters that can be had, and the players get to find their own way through it. And that's how the flow of the game goes. Let's see, what else is there? How do I go about tackling this? I guess I should talk a bit about the mechs, right? Since I've talked about the players, I've talked a bit about the villains. They're Nazis, they're the Fash, but I haven't really talked about the third major element of Extreme Meat Punks Forever, which is the mech. Every original character has a meat mech, which is a mech made of meat and bones. It's really gross and awesome. Unfortunately, so do the Fash, the cops, and the forces of capitalism, but you can use your meat mech to smash their meat mech, or push them off cliffs, or whatever. Meat mech effectiveness against eldritch forest gods not guaranteed. Everybody has a meat mech, which feels like it would be a children's storybook in the world of Extreme Meat Punks Forever. And this was the aspect that was kind of reminding me of Rifts. Just in terms of the. The elements that you put into it. Of course, mechs are a big part of the Palladium universe, but also just like the body horror aspect of it. This feels like something out of maybe the Rifts Wormwood world book. you create your mech by, you know, choosing stats for it. The mech has different stats than the OCs, than the player characters. Corpus, sinew, nerve, and viscera are the stats for the mech. You describe your mech. There are lists here of, you got to name your mech, which is, you know, the mech name is also said to be your true name, your character's true name. And yeah, then there are descriptions. They have these lists of different descriptors for the mechs. So for each stat, pick options from the list below to customize your mech further. If a stat has +2 in it, it gets to pick 3 options from that stat's list. If it has +1, it gets to pick 2 options. If it has -1, it gets to pick 1 option. And they're all things like I said, the stats for the mech are corpus, which is their body, sinew, which is their connection to the pilot, nerve, which is their abilities, powers, and interactivity with the world, and then viscera is their health, guts, and life. So corpus options are things like chunky, dry, red, marbled, grassy, salty, sunburned, lumpy, onions and garlic smell, grass-fed, sulfur butter. Nerve options include things like wiggling, protracted, bulbous, giggling, ticklish, burnt, smells like Christmas, ringing, whistling, dirty, bloody. Sinew options include spiky, intricate, massive, wet, gooey, sing-song, color-changing, and viscera, things like runny, scabbed, oily, gurgling, dripping, vomit, churning. Man, they really are gross and awesome, aren't they? You pick some options from a list. There's just extensive options that are upgrades for your mech. And this is all based off of how you assign your mech stats as well. Like, you basically get, you have those 4 stats, and then you divide +2, +1, +1, and -1 among those 4 stats. And based on how you put them, that means you get different options, like, you know, those ones I was just reading out. And then these upgrades, things like thick-skinned, you can take a hit from another mech by diving in front of them. Or if you, you know, sinew, powerful tendons, you raise your sinew by 1. So based on how you assign your stats, you get to purchase upgrades and descriptors for your mech. You choose weapons. You choose 1 weapon by default. You can choose it from the list below or make up your own cool, gross thing. Look at some of these, man. These are wild. Screaming mouth vents. Horrible vocal cord gills open up in your carapace and fire sonic grief at your enemies. Near or far range. Frankensteiner tongue. A suite of electro oil glands cover your mech's tongue, providing you a solid 6-6 and 2/3 chance of winning the fight. On a 10+ on smash, your target is stunned for a few moments and can't react to what's going on, and that's an ability for near. I guess near and far are sort of the melee versus ranged in this game terminology. There are tags for the different type of weapons. There are these things called pulses that are small add-ons to your meat mech. You can only have 1 at a time. Things like bug eyes, your sense of sight is exceptionally good. Fox ears, your sense of hearing is exceptionally good. Cloud belly, it's as if your innards are lighter than air. You move lightly and gracefully when weight matters. Sizzle skin, you can withstand fire a little longer than most. And then once you've got all of that, you've got your mech, and you got to name it, of course. And then the rule book then gets into mech moves, mech brawls. There's like entire separate move sets and rule sets pertaining to your mech versus the ones that pertain to your character. This is all, I mean, I much like Fleshscape, I really love the bizarre, squishy, and gross lore, gross aesthetic going on here. David Cronenberg's, you know, gay rifts or whatever, however you want to spin it like that. I think this has some pretty cool ideas. But like so many games like this, as I get into it, I'm like, okay, like I like what's laid out here. I think it'd be really interesting to run this. And I guess part of my question too is like, why run this system instead of, say, running like this world, but in a different system? What is the appeal? I'm sure it comes out in playthrough. It comes out in gameplay.
Well, I keep thinking, like, why don't we do, maybe for next time, is like try building me a character like we did with City of Mist.
That is what I was going to suggest, is like this episode. Yeah. I'm just giving sort of the overview of it, talking about these different aspects, the basic mechanics of how a character can move around in this world, the basic mechanics of the mech and building a mech that is like an extension of your character. It's like half of your character, and then also just touching upon, lore of the game, different scenarios, and how the game is approached practically when you're actually sitting down to play it. Maybe the last thing I'll talk about leading into next episode where we make a character is talking about the characters. We touched on them initially because you were talking about playbooks, but similar to how you might make a character, like this is the part that actually reminded me quite a bit of a Forged in the Dark game, like Teeth or Wicked Ones, these playbooks. Similar to how you created a character in those games, players choose playbooks that are like different character archetypes. The playbook has different abilities specific to that character archetype, different gear, and then a short list of special moves, and there's a variety to choose from. For example, the airwave. Look at you. How can they not? You're out there and you don't care who sees it. Your outside is a reflection of your inside, which is brimming with good gay energy. It's like reflex, just how you just channel that, how you display it, like flexing a muscle or breathing. So this is like a charismatic character, someone who's all about like looks and charm and animal magnetism. But then there's also like the bright child. Love the bright, fear the bright, behold the bright, watch the bright, protect the bright, love the bright, know the bright, guide the bright, help the bright, love the bright, judge the bright, 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 bright. That is the actual description. And they're sort of like a hippie flower child type, that has a real connection to the sky. The sky that has no sun and instead has the weird characteristics known as the bright. There are many more. The emblem, the fire breather, the honey artist, which I love the art on the honey artist. The honey artist, I guess is almost, from the art you'd say, is sort of a Harley Quinn type character. Because it's a person wearing like a skirt and fairy wings, but also big gothy stomper boots with spikes and a bloody nail-filled baseball bat. The meat shifter, this is the one that you said you like, Tom. This is like as it says here, a real Jekyll and Hyde situation you got going on there. Your body shifts from pleasing human time normal skin to terrible scorched earth ugly sound meat dermis. And the image on it of Malachi, the meat shifter, is like a person that's covered in tattoos. And then half of their body is transforming into, it almost looks like one of the Titans from Attack on Titan, like exposed muscle and sinew and flesh. The untethered, let me see here, again in the cockpit is like being stuffed back up in the womb and coming into the fresh peels of the bright is like true birth. Someone who is very into metallurgy, I guess. Metallurgy.
I think it's someone who doesn't like going in their mech.
Oh yeah, you're like right. Pay attention, nerd, is one of their moves. Whenever you roll a 10 plus while not in your mech, you can ask the GM or another player a question about what just happened. You're right. So this is someone who prefers not to engage in the mech side of Extreme Meat Punks. And then the Weird of the Wisp, you can do things with your hands and your brain and your heart that no one else can do. Strange magic. Real witch's cauldron hours. Should you get a cauldron? Would that look cool? How heavy is a cauldron? Your soul is a warped void of odd sorcery that reaches out to the end of time. That cauldron, though. So this is like a more magic-focused class, which is pretty interesting. I like that one of their moves is weird fucky dreams. When you sleep, you can choose to have strange visions about another OC. Roll plus chill on a 10 or more. They have the same dream, and you both take plus one love with each other. On a hit the next time they would fail a roll, you can take that failure instead and give them a 7 to 9 result. The GM has one hold over you and can spend it after any roll you make to give you a failure instead of whatever you got with no way to bump it up. Pretty neat. So those are the playbooks. We talked about the mechs, and I think next time, Tom, we're going to have to make up your character. We're going to have to make this meat shifter and their mech.
Hell yeah. There's examples throughout the book of like pechs of mechs with their names. They get pretty wild. One of them I really liked was called Go Ahead and Scream.
Yeah. I like Death of the Author has a brain for a face.
Yeah.
Man, pretty neat stuff. Just like very, very way out there in terms of the trappings of this game. You know, I already listed all these things that that it reminded me of. But like, you know, we loved Fleshscape. This is like Fleshscape, but to an extreme. Fleshscape meets the Gates, maybe something like that. I don't know, but. But yeah, can't wait to get into this a bit more. And maybe a good place to end this conversation, though, is, Tom, are you interested in playing the video games?
I don't know. What kind of video game are they?
They are one part visual novel and then one part, like, Atari-style brawler.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I don't know. I guess I'd be into that.
Maybe we can both check out the games before next episode and talk a little bit about them, too.
All right. Is that our episode?
I think so.
Okay, well, I don't even think I said, but, well, we sort of said it. This has been episode 183, recorded on the 28th of February, 2024. I'm pretty sure I didn't say that earlier, is the thing. If you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or follow us, contact us, anything like that, check us out on Facebook, Compare and Campaign on Facebook. If you want to see our show notes and supplemental materials, though, you can find that on compareandcampaign.wordpress.com. Who knows what they're... Oh, man, maybe my mech will just be called Not Me.
Oh, that's a good one. Or the whole meat.
Oh, man, that's true. This is a place to use the whole meat.
Level up, get that meat.